GoDaddy.com. Use the code BLU139 to get 10% off any combination of purchases at GoDaddy.com. See site for details. Get your piece of the internet at GoDaddy.com. Tango Tango Papa 1340, May 18th, 2010.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from Dunkirk, New York. I unloaded early this afternoon at Brockport, New York, and not long after I got unloaded, then they sent this load that picked up at, it's actually a midnight Eastern Time loading time, here at Dunkirk, New York, and then it delivers essentially not quite 24 hours later, but maybe 22 or 23 hours later, Tuesday evening in, now I don't even remember the name of it, some weird Goldsboro or something, Pennsylvania, never heard of before. Right now I'm at the place at where I'm going to be picking the load up at Dunkirk, New York, at this plant. And I've been here for several hours, and I'm just kind of waiting for them to come and tell me to back into the dock. So, another kind of a cloudy day today. I think it made it up into the 60s. I never really checked. And then this evening, it wouldn't surprise me if it dips down into the high 50s. So far, you know, I'm not cold yet. I'd say it's probably still maybe around 60 degrees or so. You know, right now it's like, well, their time, Eastern time here, it's about 8 minutes after 10. So I've still, depending, you know, still got a couple hours to wait before... approximately before they have me back into the dock. And now once the load is loaded, I'm planning on just spending the night right here, or, you know, somewhere either on their property if there's room, which there should be, or somewhere close by. But I think there's plenty of room here right now. And I already talked to the guy, and he said as long as there's room, then should be able to park here with no problem. And once I unload this load tomorrow evening, of course, I have no clue where I might be, you know, where they'll have me pick a load up next. It's really hard to say. That's the place where it's going is in eastern Pennsylvania. Without having looked at the map, I'm thinking it's somewhere... around the Scranton area, somewhere in that area, maybe between Scranton and Philadelphia, someplace in that area. And then so there's a number of places where they could have me pick a load up at, and, you know, so it's really hard to say. So we'll just have to sort of wait and see what happens. I have been gone in the truck now for about 15 days, and so I've kind of been debating on, you know, I could send a message, you know, normally I, you know, like to stay out three and a half weeks, and so I probably should be sending a message that I'm ready to go home. Now, you know, I wanted to get the Sprint Evo phone. You know, they did announce that they're that it's going to be available for sale on June the 4th. And I kind of thought about timing things so that, you know, I would get home around June the 4th. But, you know, the Sprint has come up with a really screwy way of... what's that thing doing? It's just really going nuts. Let me see if I can... Straight there, I dimmed the screen down. Sprint's come up with this really screwy marketing plan for the Evo. And I really don't understand why. Of course, they've generated a lot of interest. The phone is really... People hear about it and they're really interested in it because of all of the features that it has. But... They've come up with the screwy thing where they're not... You can't pre-order it on the website. You've got to actually go to either a Sprint store, which they've closed a lot of those, of course, or to Best Buy or to Radio Shack. And they really seem to be wanting to push people towards Best Buy and Radio Shack because you get an instant $100 rebate. If you buy it at Radio Shack or Best Buy, then you get an instant $100 rebate, bringing the cost down, I think, to I believe it's one, I might be mistaken, but I believe it's $199. And then if you buy it from a Sprint store on June the 4th, then you're going to pay $299, but they'll give you a certificate for a $100 rebate, which you actually have to send in, and so on and so forth. So, and then wait for the money. So obviously they're trying to direct people to either Best Buy or Radio Shack. And of course, with this screwy way that they've got it set up, you can't buy it online. So ostensibly, what you'd have to do right now, if I wanted to get one of these phones, I'd have to go into probably my local Best Buy store or a Best Buy store somewhere and place the pre-order. And then I don't know if they would actually ship the phone somewhere or if you actually have to physically go back to the same Best Buy or Radio Shack in order to pick the thing up. I don't know. It's on the June the 4th. It's a really screwy marketing thing that they've came up with. And so, you know, with all of this, you know, every business has tried to direct as many people as possible to do business on their website or through the phone, you know, through the telephone. And certainly cell phone companies have done that. They want you to call them. They want you to go on their website and do your business directly. And, you know, but in this case, here comes Sprint with this really screwy marketing idea. We're going to kind of force people to go to Best Buy and to Radio Shack. And it just doesn't make any sense. It's screwy. And so I'm kind of thinking, well, my current phone is functioning just fine. I've had this model for a little bit over 2 years. It's functioning just fine. I may wait 6 months. I'll wait until they, you know, until this Evo is no longer new, and then they'll have to drop the price. Maybe they'll, you know, then they'll, you know, then it'll be just be 50. It'll only cost me perhaps $50. You know, if I just wait a little while, you know, they'll end up dropping the price. They always do. Every phone model, even the iPhone, they had to do that. If you remember back when the original iPhone came out 3 years ago, they had a high price on it, and then they ended up just a couple, 3 weeks later, they had to drop that down. And of course, they pissed off a bunch of the people, the early adopters that had ran out and bought it at the higher price. So this is a screwy marketing thing. I don't understand it. They should try to sell as many as they possibly can, including with existing customers. I don't know, you know, they're probably thinking, well, we're going to try to get as many new customers as possible to sign up with Sprint, which is fine and dandy. But, you know, if you got a hot phone, you know, one that's really generating a lot of word of mouth and interest, then it would seem to me you'd want to get that in the hands of as many existing customers as well as new customers as possible, and then they show the other people, they show their friends and relatives, not just telling them about it, but actually show it to them, and then that makes them want to go out and buy it, and or go get it. And so, I don't know, it's screwy. So, right now I have no opportunity to get it without going through a bunch of, you know, trying to jump through a bunch of hoops, and, you know, so I'm not, you know, I'm just going to kind of ignore it for a while, and then we'll see what happens, and maybe I'll save myself, you know, $150 or whatever. You know, I just may wait. What's the hurry? You know, they're not making it easy. So, I don't know, it's screwy. I've got a couple of things here that I've got I've got another piece of audio from Scott Mitchell that does the Uncommon Sense podcast. He kind of sent me a bunch of responses to my podcast. And so that's what, you know, so I've just kind of not been playing them all at once, but I've just kind of been playing them along. So I've got one of those that I'll probably end up doing a stop-start on, as well as a TED Talks. I was listening to this, or I was actually watching this TED Talks, one of the TED Talks videos last night, and so I've got the audio from that, and I thought it was about kind of like social networking, not website social networking, but actual social networking, and you know, they were kind of studying it, and it's sort of interesting. Of course, they're just kind of studying dysfunctional human beings, and you know, and they're just kind of assuming that's just the norm, which it, sadly it is, that, you know, how people are dysfunctional, and it's an interesting talk nonetheless. But so there's some, this guy makes some interesting points that that I can bounce off of. So first of all, let me, before I forget, I want to talk a little bit about yourbabycanread.com. Your Baby Can Read is a truly revolutionary infant reading system. It was developed by a leading infant researcher, Dr. Robert Titzer, who taught his own daughter to read when she was just 9 months old. Your Baby Can Read taps into children's natural ability to learn language in the first 5 years of life. The reading system includes videos, books, flashcards, and games. Go to yourbabycanread.com to watch real home videos of infants and toddlers reading. A 6-month-old recognizing words on flashcards, an 18-month-old reading sentences, a toddler reading Charlotte's Web. Try it yourself risk-free and see what your child can do. Visit www.yourbabycanread.com. Give the gift of lifelong early literacy to your child. And so thanks to yourbabycanread.com for being a sponsor. And so let's just go ahead and jump on into Scott's comment. We're going to be listening to this together for the first time. So here is Scott.
Throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I guess that's what I'd entitle this note. What I'm talking about is what a lot of people do or infer in their solutions to things. They will basically throw the baby out with the bathwater. The specific that I'm referring to at this very moment in time has to do with an article you're reading on the podcast, which is about people getting money because of our tax structure and tax system who didn't pay any taxes. They're strictly, you know, receivers of money, and they don't contribute any in. And the implication here, Tom, is that none of this should exist. Now, you didn't come right out and say that, but that's what the implication would be, is that we shouldn't have people getting money that don't contribute anything. and maybe we shouldn't have people getting money at all. That would be the throwing the baby out with the bathwater concept. Now, if you're a solutions-oriented person, you would look at the system, you know, and I'm systems-oriented, and you'd say, all right, why does this system entice people to be lazy?
Well, now, let me interrupt. Before you go on, I just had a thought that's sort of related to this, maybe not directly, but, you know, and I'm going to preface this, as I always do, by saying I am not a parent. Never have been a parent. At 55 years of age, probably never will be a parent. However, if you have a kid, let's say you got a little kid, and I know this is very common. Let's say you have a little, because it happened to me. And I've watched it happen over and over again with kids. Let's say you have a kid, and the kid's got whatever. And, you know, and then the first thing the parent does, you know, they get it to the toddler stage. They'll say, little Johnny, little Susie, share your ice cream with so-and-so, or share this with so-and-so. Now, why did they do that? To me, they should not be doing that. A parent should not be teaching the kids to share. Now you're thinking, oh my God, you know, well they're, that, you know, because the parent's thinking, oh, that reflects badly on me if little Johnny or little Susie doesn't share whatever they have. It reflects badly on me. You've got to allow the kids. You have to allow people to be selfish. You have to allow them to be selfish, and then they're able to experience selfishness, and then they can find out the negative consequences of being selfish. But if you kind of force them to share, you know, force them, in other words, force them to do the right thing, and the parents are kind of like governments, force the kids to do the right thing, then the kids don't learn a thing. They just become programmed robots. So I believe that, you know, if I had a kid, knowing what I know, I would let that kid be selfish. I'd let that kid just, you know, experience his or her own selfishness, and then when the other kids didn't want anything to do with them, then the parent can step in and explain to them, well, you know, you hoarded all of the stuff, and the other kids didn't like it. They don't like you. You were being selfish. And explain to them what they did. And then allow them to kind of come to their own conclusion that being selfish isn't a good thing. You know, it's a bad thing to be selfish. But you've got to let the kids come to their own conclusion. You know, present them with the information and they'll come to their own conclusion. But if the parent just jumps right in and says, oh, you know, you have to share. Force them to share. Force them to do the right thing before they can have any experience on their own of not doing the right thing and then suffering the consequences afterwards. You're robbing, you know, someone that does that is robbing their kid of basically the kid's own grace, they're kind of stepping in to the role of conscience that the kids, you know, the idea of a parent should be, you know, as ideally a parent should be there to help the kid develop his or her own connection with conscience and not jump in and try to be that conscience. And so, you know, this idea, you know, it's basically communism. When a parent steps in and says, oh, you have to, you know, little Johnny, little Susie, you have to share. That's basically teaching them communism. And communism is forced sharing. We're going to force you to share. You know, and there's a huge difference between voluntarily sharing, you know, because if you voluntarily share something with somebody because it's your own idea and it's the right thing to do, that's one thing. But if somebody's forcing you to do it, it just totally ruins it. And I know that people will say, oh, well, it's all about the outcome. No, it's not. You know, because the outcome, if you want the outcome's just going to be communism. And you can't force it. You know, this idea that you can force people to do the right thing is absurd. And it doesn't work. It never does. It never will work. You can't make it work. You know, it's the same thing. You know, these people, there are always people that think, we're going to try communism, or we're going to try do the socialism. Never mind that it always fails. It's failing in Europe right now. Never mind that it fails. It just wasn't the right people that were doing it. We're better. We're going to be able to do it better. And so in any case, that's not quite related to Scott's comment so far, but it was something I was thinking about today. It's a mistake to force your kids to share. What you want to do is let them experience their own selfishness, because they're going to have it. You know, we're human beings. We're flawed. We come into this world wanting to play God. And we come into this world with some selfishness and some other negative traits. And you've got to let kids experience those negative traits so that then they find the negative consequences. And then you can kind of step in as the parent and explain to them, you know, calmly, without emotion, just matter-of-factly explain to them why selfishness is selfishness and why it's bad and why, you know, sharing is really usually a better way to go. But it just kind of depends. And so if you can stimulate, what you want to do is stimulate their own conscience, not be that conscience.
To just want to scam the system. And how could we more accurately find a way to make it so that these people wouldn't be able to do that and wouldn't want to, whatever. And they're always going to want to scam the system. We'll always be those human beings. Two things, Tom. I wonder what your solution to the problem would be of people who will always scam the system. What would your solution be? Now, I'll tell you what my solution is. And you've heard versions of it before, but in the specific...
Now, let me interrupt again. Another thought kind of popped into my head along the lines of what I was talking about. Let's say that you got kids together, let's say it's a mom or a dad that, you know, that comes in and says, "Little Susie, little Johnny, you have to share your ice cream with Fred over here, or Julie, or what, you know, with some other kid. You got to share your marbles. You got to share your Legos. You got to share whatever. Share your ice cream." Well, that teaches not only that ruins it, it kind of, you're stepping in as a wedge between little Johnny or little Susie's them and their conscience. You're stepping into that role and screwing them up, because then they resent you, because they, you know, that can be a point of resentment, because you're stepping in as the parent inappropriately, as a wedge between them and their conscience, because you want to let them experience the negative consequences, and then you can be the conscience on the outside. Once they're experiencing the negative consequences, then you kind of throw them back on themselves and let them experience that conscience, and that will really teach them a lesson. But if you look at it from the other point of view, the other kid, then little Fred or little Julie or whoever the other kids are getting something for free. You know, they're just, you know, they're being taught the wrong thing, that this other kid has to share. You know, he just has to because his mom told him to or his dad told him to. They have to share. So I can just all I have to do is just be there, and I'm going to get the goodies anyway. And that teaches them the wrong lesson, and which is equally bad. So, but in any case, let's go ahead and listen to some more of Scott's comment.
Case. I don't agree that we just completely get rid of all of the tax breaks and maybe even money back that these people would get. What I would say is it needs to go to the needy. And so we need to determine how to use this money more efficiently by looking for other things. For instance, have these people have a requirement for them to show that they have been looking for work or looking to upgrade their work if they're underemployed. And then they might be able to get the benefit.
Well, now the problem with even the way unemployment is structured, there are plenty of people, and I've had to be on unemployment a couple of times, briefly, and there are plenty of people, you know, the way they have it structured, they want you to go out and, you know, search for, you know, it depends on the state, you know, some of them will, you know, they want you to call different businesses, some of them actually want you to physically go to the business. They've got it structured differently, but I was listening to something the other day, and there was this story about somebody actually being offered a job as a result of their this requirement, whatever state it was, required them to do a job search, and they actually got offered a job, and as the story went, they were saying, "Oh no, I don't want to. Can I come back and basically take a rain check? I don't want to come back. I don't want to go to work immediately. Let's wait till next Friday or next Monday so that I don't mess up my unemployment." You know, so unemployment, when you start extending the benefits, that really gives people a disincentive to get out and beat the bushes or to actually work. I think it's, you know, and then the way they do all these tax credits, it's possible for people to, you know, this so-called earned income tax credit, it's possible to, you know, for people to not pay any taxes at all and yet get a check from the, an IRS check from the federal government. And, you know, I think it's just, it's all structured wrong. You know, you want to structure it so that there's as least paperwork as possible. And, you want to structure it so that, you know, people actually have to get out and look for work. You want to structure it so people actually have to, you know, be industrious. Instead of, you know, just kind of sitting there on their rear ends and watching television all day or whatever. And, you know, there over the years, I've heard of plenty of cases where people were just kind of sitting around, not doing anything and collecting their government check for whatever, you know, whether it's unemployment or, you know, and it's common to hear people say, "Well, I'll just stay on my unemployment for a while." You know, I've heard that over and over and over again over the years. So we're basically what's happening. The government, and it's been going on for a long time. It's really being exacerbated right now, but it's been in the works for many, 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 many years. And under both political parties, it's not something that's cropped up just overnight. It's been around for a long time. But basically, they're setting about the system is the effect of this system. It's creating as many broken people as possible. Where our system is creating, we'll put it, you know, I'm going to use some different language we're really not used to in the United States. It's creating broken people, peasants. We're destroying the middle class. The middle class is slowly being destroyed. I think we can agree on that. And so the middle class is being destroyed, and they're creating as many broken people as possible, spiritually broken, psychologically broken, financially broken people as possible. A peasant class, a permanent peasant underclass, as large as possible, and then those people are dependent. They're dependent on the government. They're dependent on the government for everything. And the only way, you know, once, let's say, you know, it's always useful if you take this back to just the basic family unit to discover the principles. Let's say that you've got a kid, you know, that one or the other or both parents have spoiled. And it's happened a lot, you know, where you have an adult child. They're not a child anymore. They're an adult living with mom and dad. And it's happening more and more, not only in the United States, but in... heard something the other day. It was like Italy or Spain, maybe Italy. They've come up with a name for it. I can't remember what the name is, but it's becoming more and more common. So let's say you've got this. Let's say they're 25 years old or 30 years old. And they, you know, maybe they've moved out, but then they've moved back in, and they don't want to leave. And they're just occupying their room or whatever, and mom and dad are feeding them and doing the laundry and you know, kind of providing for them, and they just won't get out on their own. You know, and maybe they're on drugs. Sometimes they're on drugs, or they're just lazy and they just lay around all the time. Maybe they have a job, but then, you know, they won't leave. They just maybe sit around and play video games when they're not working. So, what do you do with someone like that? Do you try to wean them off of mom and dad? You know, mom and dad are sort of like government support. You just try to wean them off? No. What you have to do, you take the tough love approach. You kick them out. You just toss them out and say, I'm sorry, it's my fault. I want to apologize. I've ruined your character. I've given you too much. I've spoiled you. And I've done, you know, I didn't know any better. I see my mistake. I'm sorry. But the only thing I can do is kick you out. And you just follow up on it. Toss them out. Maybe they end up in the gutter. You know, you're kind of presenting them with a sink or swim proposition. And that's really the best thing that, you know, that you can do in a case like that, where you've got a kid that you've kind of created a parasite, sort of a financial, emotional parasite, really a spiritual parasite too, you know, with the kind of, because of course, why would a parent do that to the kid? Oh, because they're playing God in the kid's life. So the best thing you can do is just toss them out. So cut them off. Let's just cut these programs, just slice it off, and just say, sorry, we're going to change. We have to change. We can't just wean you away or try to reduce the thing. We're just going to cut you out. You know, and let the chips fall where they may. Maybe you end up in the gutter, or maybe you either sink or you swim. And that's the tough love approach, and that's the only approach that has any possibility of actually working.
Because it might be that they're honestly, you know, unemployed that year. Or underemployed that year. It could happen to me. It could happen to you. And you would be very glad to have some of these things happen. It would be, you know, something I would think you'd be grateful for if you were in that position. And it would be deserved if you'd always been a hard-working American and you intended to be one again. And somebody was helping you while you were down and out. God knows, most, you know, decent people would be grateful for that. But of course, there are a lot of people who are not decent people. So for them, you know, what you've got to do at least is show that you've been looking for work, that you're not just doing things to scam the system. So require some kind of proof. And also, I would say, do a study, and it should be an ongoing thing, where you have somebody go out and, you know, various types of people even go out and try to get work and see how long it takes them to get work in maybe various areas. Have ways to perhaps, you wouldn't even need to have it. Maybe you could actually study some people in, you know, using the system and data mining the system. How long does it take the average person to find a job after they've become laid off in a particular area? Because it will vary from area to area. Computers could very easily data mine this stuff with data probably readily available from our unemployment services. And they would have a pretty good idea of about how long it should take somebody to get a job. Take that amount of time and add, like, just to be lenient, add 40% to it. And beyond that period of time, you don't get the breaks, because you're obviously not working for work, because an average person would have already done it sooner than you, and 40% time added.
Well, let me interrupt again. Another thought just kind of popped into my head. Our unemployment system, of course, you know, you have to, you're paying into it, the employer's paying into it. And, you know, I've been on unemployment a couple of times, briefly, and I was, you know, it helped me through the, you know, the short period of unemployment. But, you know, just thinking about the way unemployment works, what happens when unemployment runs out? I know that they just extended it for, you know, they passed some kind of an extension. But what happens when it actually runs out? People either go out and they really start looking and they get a job, or they come up with some, you know, people that are industrious come up with some kind of a business or some way of making money. You know, and I know, you know, there are going to people say, oh, well, they're out stealing or whatever. No, there are people that actually, if you keep just giving them a little bit of money along, just so that they don't, you know, so that they're just sort of comfortable, they can just kind of get by, then there's a lot of people that won't become industrious. They'll just kind of sit there and wait and wait and wait. Until they're, you know, because you're always talking about pain, pleasure. Well, you know, the problem with unemployment, you know, giving people an unemployment benefit beyond a certain point is that, you know, you can make them comfortable, you know, during the transition. But if you make that transition period, you turn that into something more permanent, then people are too comfortable and they don't... you know, it's got to be uncomfortable. And, you know, in some states I've heard people are getting ridiculous amounts of money. They're being paid, you know, it varies by state because all of these depend on state laws. But people are getting ridiculous amounts of money to just sit at home and do nothing. And it does stop people. It takes their incentive away for really being industrious, because if you really have to come up with money, then you'll come up with some way of making some money. You know, I periodically get emails from people, you know, saying, oh, I've, you know, there's just no jobs around here, I can't find a job. Well, you know, there's things you could do. I mean, you just stand out, you know, start your own little, buy some cleaning supplies. And, you know, market yourself. You know, you can make up probably about $100, $75 to $100 per truck cleaning the interior of a truck. You know, now you're not going to get every truck driver you talk to isn't going to bite on it. But if you were in the right place at the right time, they would. And so that would be a way of... actually coming up, if you were physically able, actually, you know, making your own business, cleaning trucks. And if you really did it and you did a good job, and you got in, you know, let's say a trucking company terminal that would let you in there, and the drivers would be paying you to clean the trucks, then, you know, two or three trucks a day, you know, you'd be doing pretty well for your own business. So there are ways of making money if you want to work. You know, you make your own business. But of course, you know, if you're on unemployment and, you know, that just keeps continuing and continuing and continuing, and then you can just kind of sit there and play on your computer, or you can sit there and watch television, and you're kind of not really that uncomfortable. It does rob you of your incentive.
And that would be an easy statistic to come up with and apply. And so, you know, those would be the two things I think you'd have to show, is that you were looking for work. Or that would be the one thing you'd have to show. And then you'd have to have that statistic available to know, you know, if these people were looking for work, how likely is it that they're not finding work? Because a lot of times people will look for work and just refuse it. You know, they won't look all that hard. They'll go for the interview and purposely disqualify themselves and things like that. There are scammers. There will always scam. But I don't think it would be tough to set up a system that could catch these rats in a trap. And then, once you've done that and you don't pay them any money, you've got more money to pay the people who really deserve it, and a little bit of that money even, in fact, to keep the statistics up to know how long it takes somebody to find a job if they're really looking. That would be my solution. I'd love to hear what yours is, but you know, that's what I'd like to see, because I'm not for throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Which is what you'd do if you say, you know, there's some people scamming the system, so that system shouldn't even exist. I mean, that's the baby in bathwater.
Okay, well, thank you, Scott. And of course, you can find Scott's podcast at scottpodcast.com. I think that we should have an unemployment system, and we've had one for years and years. You know, and I think we should have one, but it shouldn't make people too comfortable. It should be for a limited time period, and it shouldn't make people too comfortable. You know, because, again, if you make people too comfortable, they'll just kind of sit there and not do anything. And that's not good. You want to give people an incentive. You don't want to rob them of their incentive to be industrious. Again, you go back to the average, you know, to the so-called nuclear family. You know, if you know, I've heard it over and over again, parents, if they give the kids too much, you know, they buy them everything that they want, and they give them everything, and the kids don't have to work for anything, then it actually robs them of their own incentive, and of course they don't understand what has happened, but they know they've been robbed of something, and they actually hate their parents for spoiling them. They hate their parents for spoiling them, for giving them everything, and the parents not teaching them how to work. Basically, the parents are, again, kind of driving a wedge between the kid and his or her own common sense, his or her own connection to common sense. And you know, if you just give the kid, you know, you give the kid chores, and then you give them then they can work and make an allowance, or you get them to, you know, kind of come up with their own business, you know, the proverbial lemonade stand, or mowing lawns, or you know, different things like that. There are kids that I see these stories all the time, where kids today have the internet, and you know, these industrious kids are coming up with some really brilliant ideas for online stores and so on and so forth. So, you know, but the idea is that you know, you don't want to spoil people. You want to do what you can to, and especially when it comes to government programs, don't, you know, because it becomes too easy for the government program to drive a wedge between people and their common sense, people and their own industriousness. Because, you know, if there's nothing like, if, you know, I need money to eat, I need money to pay my bills, and there's nothing like that real pressure, I really need that money, there's nothing like that to motivate me. You know, there's, you know, and if it becomes just too easy to get money otherwise for doing nothing, then a lot of people are just going to do nothing, and they're going to take the money and be dependent, and not have to, you know, and sort of be severed from that connection with their own common sense, be severed from becoming industrious and being industrious. And so there should be, we should have a system, but it shouldn't last more than, I don't know, we just pick a, you know, what is the average unemployment? You know, 6 weeks, 12 weeks, and that should be it. And beyond that, then, you know, it should be, you know, people have to get out and do something. And it's a mistake to just keep extending it. I know that, of course, in the media, they always come up with all these sob stories about, oh, these poor people, and they've got all their payments and what have you. Well, they should have been more responsible. Of course, you know, we all should be more responsible, but, you know, if we have all these little safety things that are going to save us, then of course we can be irresponsible. It just enables the wrong behavior, and it enables the problem with a lot of government programs is that it encourages the worst of human behavior. It encourages rotten character to develop. It teaches people to be rotten, and in any case, I've also got this, I guess, how long is this? Let's go ahead and do this. It's a TED Talks, let me see if I can figure out the guy's name. Let's see here, the fellow's name is Nicholas Christakis. And he's talking about the hidden influence of social networks, and it's kind of interesting. So let's go ahead and listen to that.
This story begins about 15 years ago when I was a hospice doctor at the University of Chicago, and I was taking care of people who were dying and their families in the South Side of Chicago. And I was observing what happened to people and their families over the course of their terminal illness. And in my lab, I was studying the widower effect, which is a very old idea in the social sciences, going back 150 years, known as dying of a broken heart. So when I die, my wife's risk of death can double, for instance, in the first year. And I had gone to take care of one particular patient, a woman who was dying of dementia. And in this case, unlike this couple, she was being cared for by her daughter. And the daughter was exhausted from caring for her mother. And the daughter's husband, he also was sick from his wife's exhaustion. And I was driving home one day, and I get a phone call from the husband's friend, calling me because he was depressed about what was happening to his friend. So here I get this call from this random guy that's having an experience that's being influenced by people at some social distance. And so I suddenly realized two very simple things. First, the widowhood effect was not restricted to husbands and wives. And second, it was not restricted to pairs of people. And I started to see the world in a whole new way, like pairs of people connected to each other. And then I realized that these individuals would be connected into foursomes with other pairs of people nearby. And that, in fact, these people were embedded in other sorts of relationships, marriage and spousal and friendship and other sorts of ties. And that, in fact, these connections were vast. and that we were all embedded in this broad set of connections with each other. So I started to see the world in a completely new way, and I became obsessed with this. I became obsessed with how it might be that we're embedded in these social networks and how they affect our lives. So social networks are these intricate things of beauty, and they are so elaborate and so complex and so ubiquitous, in fact, that one has to ask what purpose they serve. Why are we embedded in social networks? I mean, how do they form? How do they operate? And how do they affect us? And so my first topic with respect to this was not death, but obesity. And it had become trendy to speak about the obesity epidemic. And along with my collaborator, James Fowler, we began to wonder whether obesity really was epidemic and could it spread from person to person like the four people I discussed earlier. So this is a slide of some of our initial results. It's 2,200 people in the year 2000. Every dot is a person. We make the dot size proportional to people's body size. So bigger dots are bigger people. And in addition, if your body size, if your BMI, your body mass index is above 30, if you're clinically obese, we also color the dots yellow. So if you look at this image right away, you might be able to see that there are clusters of obese and non-obese people in the image. But the visual complexity is still very high. It's not obvious exactly what's going on. In addition, some questions are immediately raised. How much clustering is there? Is there more clustering than would be due to chance alone? How big are the clusters? How far do they reach? And most importantly, what causes the clusters? So we did some mathematics to study the size of these clusters. This here shows on the y-axis the increase in the probability that a person is obese given that a social contact of theirs is obese, and on the x-axis the degrees of separation between the two people. And on the far left you see the purple line. It says that if your friends are obese, your risk of obesity is 45% higher. And the next bar over, the orange line, says if your friends' friends are obese, your risk of obesity is 25% higher. And then the next line over says if your friend's friend, someone you probably don't even know is obese, your risk of obesity is 10% higher. And it's only when you get to your friend's friend's friends that there's no longer a relationship between that person's body size and your own body size. Well, what might be causing this clustering? There are at least three possibilities. One possibility is that as I gain weight, it causes you to gain weight, a kind of induction, a kind of spread from person to person. Another possibility, very obvious, is homophily, or birds of a feather flock together. Here, I form my tie to you because you and I share a similar body size. And the last possibility is what is known as confounding, because it confounds our ability to figure out what's going on. And here the idea is not that my weight gain is causing your weight gain, nor that I preferentially form a tie with you because you and I share the same body size, but rather that we share a common exposure to something like a health club that makes us both lose weight at the same time. And when we studied these data, we found evidence for all of these things, including for induction. And we found that if your friend becomes obese, it increases your risk of obesity by about 57% in the same given time period. And there can be many mechanisms for this effect. One possibility is that your friends say to you something like, you know, they adopt a behavior that spreads to you, like they say, let's go have muffins and beer, which is a terrible combination. But you adopt that combination, and then you start gaining weight like them. And another more subtle possibility is that they start gaining weight, and it changes your ideas of what an acceptable body size is. And here what's...
Now, let me interrupt. There are, you know, knowing what I know about how people behave, you know, there's a... Part of it is the birds of a feather thing. You know, it's like people that I've talked about before that drink alcohol, and let's say that people hang out in bars, and they like to drink, and maybe they're an alcoholic, and or maybe they're not alcoholic but they drink a lot, you know, so-called social drinkers. Well, you know, I've been in the situation, because I don't drink, I've never liked the taste of it, I stay away from it. But there are people that, you know, I've been in situations plenty of times, particularly with, you know, friends and relatives both. But in those situations where some people, you know, they'll try to keep offering you a drink. Well, why don't you take a drink? Well, I don't want it. Sorry, I don't drink. You know, and they'll keep on, and you can tell sometimes that you're making them, they're just not really comfortable because, you know, everybody's drinking and you're not. And it's almost like you're kind of reminding them that, you're sort of like you're reminding them on the outside of what, you know, maybe they feel guilty on the inside. You know, they've got this guilt problem with drinking, and they sort of, you know, surround themselves with people that like to drink, you know, and then they feel better about it. You know, crying your beer together. So you have that type of thing. And then you've got another, there's this other possibility, you know, he's talking about induction, is the term that he used. And let's say that you are really emotionally resentment type emotion, emotionally involved with, you know, not necessarily a friend, but a relative, a mom or a dad that's, you know, that's just really dysfunctional, and you resent them. Chances are you're going to end up with their disease, you know, whether it's overeating or a wrong relationship with food, and I think that that's really a big part of the obesity, the so-called obesity epidemic, as well as the this type 2 diabetes epidemic. Really revolves around people becoming more and more and more dysfunctional. And, you know, then those types of diseases do spread emotionally or through resentment. They, you know, diseases like that really can spread via resentment. So anyway, let's go on.
Spreading from person to person is not a behavior, but rather a norm. An idea is spreading. Now, headline writers had a field day with our studies. I think the headline in the New York Times was, you know, are you packing it on? Blame your fat friends. What was interesting to us is the European headline writers had a different take. They said, you know, are your friends gaining weight? Perhaps you are to blame. And we thought this was a very interesting comment on America, you know, kind of self-serving, you know, not my responsibility kind of phenomenon. Now, I want to be very clear, we do not think our work should or could justify prejudice against people of one or another body size at all. Now, our next question was, could we actually visualize this spread? Was weight gain in one person actually spreading to weight gain in another person? And this is complicated because we needed to take into account the fact that the network structure, the architecture of the ties, was changing across time. And in addition, because obesity is not a unicentric epidemic, there's not a patient zero of the obesity epidemic. We find that guy, you know, there was a spread of obesity out from him. It's a multicentric epidemic. Lots of people are doing things at the same time. And I'm about to show you a 30-second video animation that took me 5 years, me and James, 5 years of our lives to do. And so again, every dot is a person. Every tie between them is a relationship. And we're going to put this into motion now, taking daily cuts through the network for about 30 years. The dot sizes are going to grow. You're going to see a sea of yellow take over. You're going to see people be born and die. Dots will appear and disappear. Ties will form and break. Marriages will and divorces. Friendings and defriendings. A lot of complexity. A lot is happening just in these 30-year period that includes the obesity epidemic. And by the end, you're going to see clusters of obese and non-obese individuals within the network. Now, when I looked at this, it changed the way I see things. Because this thing, this network that's changing across time has a memory. It moves. Things flow within it. It has a kind of consistency. People can die, but it doesn't die. It still persists. And it has a kind of resilience that allows it to persist across time. And so I came to see these kinds of social networks as living things. As living things that we could put under a kind of microscope and study and analyze and understand. And we used a variety of techniques to do this, and we started exploring all kinds of other phenomena. So we looked at smoking and drinking behavior and voting behavior and divorce, which can spread, and altruism. And eventually we became interested in emotions. Now, when we have emotions, we show them. Why do we show our emotions? I mean, there would be an advantage to experiencing our emotions inside, you know, anger or happiness. But we don't just experience them, we show them. And not only do we show them, but others can read them. And not only can they read them, but they copy them. There's emotional contagion that takes place in human populations. And so this function of emotions suggests that, in addition to any other purpose they serve, they're a kind of primitive form of communication. and that it...
Okay, again, and I do agree with him. They're kind of a primitive form of communication. How does emotion spread from one person to another? Resentment. That's how it spreads. And, you know, you think about this. How is it? You know, you wake up in the morning and you're feeling fine, and then you end up being around somebody that's mad. You know, that's, we've all had this experience. Does that ruin your day? How can that ruin your day? How can that emotion spread to you? It spreads to you through resentment. And so, basically, what this guy is observing, he's observing and he thinks, oh, this is just normal behavior. Unfortunately, he's right. But it's spreading. All of these things end up kind of spreading because of resentment. The presence of resentment. If you take the resentment out, you know, and you can really only do that individually, but if, you know, let's say that there's, you know, and it happens to me all the time, you know, that some of these shippers and receivers that I go to, you know, there's, let's say I go in and there's somebody that's just rah, 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 and they're rude or whatever. I don't resent them. You know, they have they've got their emotional whatever. They're in their emotional turmoil. They didn't project it into me. So basically what he's observing is a lot of projection that ends up going on. And it's not normal behavior, even though it's prevalent. It's, you know, it's all over the place. He's observing human beings in kind of a fallen state. And, you know, so if you, you know, the... What I want to say is that if you don't want to be subject to what he's talking about, give up resentment. Learn to give up resentment. I don't talk about it much. You go to my website, truckertompodcast.com. Up at the top, there's a link that says meditation. Click on that. That'll take you to a page on the website where there are 3 files that are hosted. On my site, you can right-click, download those, burn them to CD, put them on your MP3 player, or listen to them on your computer directly. And it's just basically, it's a simple, very simple technique that will help you, if you practice it, it will help you to sort of, you know, separate from your thoughts. And to become more aware. And that's how you really learn not, or, you know, you get yourself into a situation where you're not subject to the people around you. You know, basically this guy, I'm going to put it in a sort of biblical terms. You know, there's this saying in the Bible, you know, be in the world but not of it. This guy is studying people that are of the world. There may be some exceptions in there, but mostly he's just looking at the effects of what happens with people that are of the world. And he's looking at all these different, he's studying all these different comings and goings of social effects, because people are kind of the world and they're all sort of affected by each other, rather than just being in the world, but not of it.
In fact, if we really want to understand human emotions, we need to think about them in this way. Now, we're accustomed to thinking about emotions in this way in simple, sort of brief periods of time. So, for example, I was giving this talk recently in New York City, and I said, you know, like how when you're on the subway and the other person across the subway car smiles at you, and you just instinctively smile back. And they looked at me and said, we don't do that in New York City. And I said, everywhere else in the world, that's normal human behavior. And so there's a very instinctive way in which we briefly transmit emotions to each other. And in fact, emotional contagion can be broader still, like we can have punctuated expressions of anger, as in riots. The question that we wanted to ask was, could emotions spread in a more sustained way than riots across time and involve large numbers of people, not just these pair of individuals smiling at each other in the subway car. Maybe there's a kind of below-the-surface quiet riot that animates us all the time. Maybe there are emotional stampedes that ripple through human social networks. Maybe, in fact, emotions have a collective existence, not just an individual existence. And this is one of the first images we made to study this phenomenon. Again, a social network, but now we color the people yellow if they're happy, and blue if they're sad, and green in between. And if you look at this image, you can right away see clusters of happy and unhappy people, again, spreading to 3 degrees of separation. And you might form the intuition that the unhappy people occupy a different structural location within the network. So there's a middle and an edge to this network, and the unhappy people seem to be located at the edges. So to invoke another metaphor, if you imagine social networks as a kind of vast fabric of humanity, I'm connected to you and you to her, on out endlessly into the distance. This fabric is actually like an old-fashioned American quilt, and it has patches on it, happy and unhappy patches. And whether you become happy or not depends in part on whether you occupy a happy patch. So this work with emotions, which are so fundamental, then got us to thinking about maybe the fundamental causes of human social networks are somehow encoded in our genes. Because human social networks, whenever they are mapped, always kind of look like this, the picture of the network. But they never look like this. Why do they not look like this? Why don't we form human social networks that look like a regular lattice? Well, the striking patterns of human social networks, their ubiquity and their apparent purpose, beg questions about whether we evolved to have human social networks in the first place and whether we evolved to form networks with a particular structure. And so notice, first of all, so to understand this, though, we need to dissect network structure a little bit first. And notice that every person in this network has exactly the same structural location as every other person. But that's not the case with real networks. So, for example, here is a real network of college students at an elite Northeastern university. And now I'm highlighting a few dots. And if you look here at the dots, compare node B in the upper left to node D in the far right. And B has 4 friends coming out from him, and D has 6 friends coming out from him. And so those two individuals have different numbers of friends. That's very obvious. We all know that. But certain other aspects of social network structure are not so obvious. Compare node B in the upper left to node A in the lower left. And now those people both have 4 friends, but A's friends all know each other, and B's friends do not. So the friend of a friend of A's is back again a friend of A's. Whereas the friend of a friend of B's is not a friend of B's, is farther away in the network. This is known as transitivity in networks. And finally, compare nodes C and D. C and D both have 6 friends. If you talk to them, they would say, and you said, what is your social life like? They would say, I've got 6 friends. That's my social experience. But now we, with a bird's eye view, looking at this network, can see that they occupy very different social worlds. And I can cultivate that intuition in you by just asking you, who would you rather be if a deadly germ was spreading through the network? Would you rather be C or D? You'd rather be D, on the edge of the network. And now who would you rather be if a juicy piece of gossip, not about you, was spreading through the network? Now you would rather be C. So different structural locations have different implications for your life. And in fact, when we did some experiments looking at this, what we found is that 46% of the variation in how many friends you have is explained by your genes. And this is not surprising. We know some people are born shy and some are born gregarious. That's obvious. But we also found some non-obvious things. For instance, 47% in the variation in whether your friends know each other is attributable to your genes. Whether your friends know each other has not just to do with their genes, but with yours. And we think the reason for this is that some people like to introduce their friends to each other, you know who you are, and others of you keep them apart and don't introduce your friends to each other. And so some people knit together the networks around them, creating a kind of dense web of ties in which they're comfortably embedded. And finally, we even found that 30% of the variation in whether or not people are in the middle or on the edge of the network can also be attributed to their genes. So whether you find yourself in the middle or on the edge is also partially heritable. Now, what is the point of this? How does this help us understand? How does this help us figure out some of the problems that are affecting us these days? Well, the argument I'd like to make is that networks have value. They are a kind of social capital. New properties emerge because of our embeddedness in social networks. And these properties inhere in the structure of the networks, not just in the individuals within them. So think about these two common objects. They're both made of carbon. And yet, one of them has carbon atoms in it that are arranged in one particular way on the left, and you get graphite, which is soft and dark. But if you take the same carbon atoms and interconnect them a different way, you get diamond, which is clear and hard. And those properties of softness and hardness and darkness and clearness do not reside in the carbon atoms. They reside in the interconnections between the carbon atoms, or at least arise because of the interconnections between the carbon atoms. So similarly, the pattern of connections among people confers upon people, the groups of people, different properties. It is the ties between people that makes the whole greater than the sum of its parts. And so it is not just what's happening to these people, whether they're losing weight or gaining weight or becoming rich or becoming poor or becoming happy or not becoming happy, that affects us. It's also the actual architecture of the ties around us. Our experience of the world depends on the actual structure of the networks in which we're residing and on all the kinds of things that ripple and flow through the network. Now, the reason, I think, that this is the case is that human beings assemble themselves and form a kind of superorganism. Now, superorganism is a collection of individuals which show or evince behaviors or phenomena that are not reducible to the study of individuals and must be understood by reference to and by studying the collective. Like, for example, a hive of bees that's finding a new nesting site, or a flock of birds that's evading a predator, or a flock of birds that's able to pool their wisdom and navigate and find a tiny speck of an island in the middle of the Pacific, or a pack of wolves that's able to bring down larger prey. Superorganisms have properties that cannot be understood just by studying the individuals. I think understanding social networks and how they form and operate can help us understand not just health and emotions, but all kinds of other phenomena, like crime and warfare, and economic phenomena, like bank runs and market crashes, and the adoption of innovation and the spread of product adoption. Now, look at this. I think we form social networks because the benefits of a connected life outweigh the costs. If I was always violent towards you, or gave you misinformation, or made you sad, or infected you with deadly germs, you would cut the ties to me and the network would disintegrate. So the spread of good and valuable things is...
Let me interrupt. Not true. Not true. Do you have relatives that are bullies? You know, maybe you have friends that are. You know, you try to be friends with the bully. But how many dysfunctional relatives do you have? And instead of just walking away, you can't let go of them. And of course, you can't let go of them because of resentment. You know, let's say you're an abused spouse. You can't let go of the abuser. Or you get rid of one abuser and you get one that's worse. Jump from the frying pan into the fire. So, you know, you can't, just because somebody is toxic, let's say you have a toxic person, you can't necessarily just walk away from them. Again, because of resentment. And then that toxic person infects you.
Required to sustain and nourish social networks. Similarly, social networks are required for the spread of good and valuable things, like love and kindness and happiness and altruism and ideas. I think, in fact, that if we realized how valuable social networks are, we'd spend a lot more time nourishing them and sustaining them. Because I think social networks are fundamentally related to goodness. And what I think the world needs now is more connections. Thank you.
Okay, so that was the audio from TED Talks video. The fellow's name is Nicholas Christankis. The Hidden Influence of Social Networks. And it's very interesting. You know, because he's basically mapping actual, you know, real social networks, people with, you know, and I'm assuming he's doing kind of friends in person type thing, but, you know, and he's not even taking into account the internet and the, you know, the social networks like Facebook, Twitter, phenomena such as podcasting, so on and so forth. You know, podcasting, for example, does create vast social networks. And, you know, it's been my experience that because of, you know, with you know, once I started podcasting, all of a sudden I, made more friends in a short period of time. I made more friends than I had during, you know, my previous entire life up to that point. You know, until I started, you know, got involved in podcasting, started podcasting. So, you know, social networks are very interesting. You know, but again, what he's kind of talking about is he's sort of observing people in sort of their dysfunctional state. You know, and but nonetheless, it's quite interesting. It's interesting, you know, the way he's kind of mapping things, and you know, and you can watch this video, and he shows the video, you know, the animation that he talked about, and it's very interesting. So, anyhow, probably better be cutting this off. It's about, what time is it? It's 11:23 Eastern Time. I think they just had a truck back into the dock. It's not me. So I'm going to see if I can get this thing uploaded and get it published. So I hope everyone is having a great week so far. And I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.